Good morning, council. Our next case for today, last case on oral arguments is A18-0639, State v. Dylan David Tom. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Make sure you just state your name and the party you're representing. Counsel, you may proceed. Yeah.
Your Honors, counsel, thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Luke Haskamp on behalf of appellant Dylan Tom. Your Honors, appellant submits that this is a simple case, but an important one. Before law enforcement can constitutionally seize someone, they must have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity by that individual to justify a seizure. And that's the showing the state cannot make. Prior to the seizure here, law enforcement could point to no articulable facts specific to Mr. Tom to reasonably suspect him of any criminal activity. Indeed, by the time they seized him, when they woke him up in the bed in this hotel room, right, they didn't really know anything about him at all. Everything the officers knew related to two other individuals was observed at another location in a car that was not owned by Mr. Tom, that involved a single marijuana pipe and a container with some marijuana wax residue that had no apparent connection to Mr. Tom. The only thing the officers learned about Mr. Tom was that he rented a hotel room where these other two individuals were staying.
Counsel, didn't one of the officers see the first individual go back and forth to the room, and then the second individual go back and forth to the room from the vehicle, and then the second individual come to the vehicle, and that second individual is staying in the same room as the first individual and Mr. Tom?
That's correct. Yes.
So there is a connection between the three individuals, correct?
Somewhat, yes. The officer states that he sees the individual come down to the car, rummage in it for about a minute, and then leaves, wanders back to the hotel. He does not see what room he enters into, but assumes he goes into a room. Then he does come back, and then the second guy does the same thing. But the officer can't see what room he's going into. But after the officer approaches and does discuss, yes, Schutz is the one of the friend's names, if he's got a room at the hotel, and he does say, I'm staying in, my friend has rented the room. I think that's the extent of the discussion. It's room 340. I have a key to the room. And so that's, I think, as much as connects anything that's happening in this parking lot with these other individuals to, not even to my client, just to his hotel room. And
well, I was just going to ask, because this is, in some ways, isn't this something that always happens in a drug bust, that there's going to be people in the home at the time of the drug bust that the officers haven't seen them doing anything, but they're there, the drugs are there, and they're always seized. They aren't free to leave because the officers usually freeze the scene. How's this any different?
Well, I think than
the typical drug bust where you have a lot of people in a house.
Sure.
Around drugs.
Correct. But I think here, really what, there's maybe a stronger connection to that drug bust, that house, than there is here. Again, what we find, the only thing that is observed, the only paraphernalia is observed, is a single marijuana pipe and a container with some marijuana wax residue. When the officer is observing these individuals walking back and forth between the hotel, they're not seen carrying anything. There's no testimony that they have any drugs on them. They tell the officer when he asks that there are no drugs in the room. And I think what's important,
Didn't the officer, though, have reason to believe that these individuals might have drugs in the room, KJ or AS, setting aside Mr. Tom for a moment?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. When we're, again, the only thing that is found is a single marijuana pipe and this container with some marijuana wax residue. It's not sufficient to think there's a drug transaction or any distribution happening. The officers never see them carry anything back and forth between this room. The only thing they say about the room at all is, I'm staying in room 340, which was rented by my friend.
But wasn't the what gave rise to the reasonable suspicions, or the alleged reasonable suspicions, was that these guys were going back and forth. And he identified the room where he was, and the officer apparently had a reasonable suspicion that not only were there drugs in this car, which turned out to be accurate, but there were drugs in this room where he was staying.
Sure. So I think we would dispute that there was reasonable suspicion to seize the other individuals. It's an academic exercise a bit, since we don't have standing to challenge that. But both Minnesota and the U.S. Constitution still require an individualized assessment as to each individual that is going to be seized.
Well, and I understand that, except in this case, I think we have to answer the question, does the officer have a lawful right to be in that room in the first place? And, I mean, I think we have to get there because we can't, I mean, you're basically asking us to analyze this case, each individual case in a vacuum, but they're all interrelated. I mean, and the officer got there because of the actions of these two other individuals other than Mr. Vaughn, but he claims he had a reasonable basis and apparently had some consent or apparent consent to enter the room.
Correct. Yes, and so
I don't know how we can divide his lawful entry into that room from the circumstances involving Mr. Vaughn.
Okay, but I think we can, Your Honor.
How can we?
So there's a question of whether the officer lawfully enters the room, and there's a question of whether the officers lawfully seize Mr. Tan, and they're separate inquiries. So we have briefed the issue of whether the officer had authority or apparent authority to walk into the room. He states that he's investigating also this unregistered guest violation on one hand, but on the other hand, believes that Mr. Schutz, AS, the individual, has apparent authority to let him in the room. We think that is not credible. The district court stated in its order that it was uncomfortable with that. But even if the officer gets into the room lawfully, there's a second inquiry required, is whether Mr. Tan is lawfully seized. That is, the Askruth decision is one we cited, which requires that the basis for the intrusion must be individualized toward the person whom the intrusion is directed. And so, sure, maybe the officers can seize the two friends, but you still got to show what's the reasonable suspicion as to Mr. Tan. And all we know is that he's, or at least a friend said he is the guy who rented this room where he's at. There's no reasonable basis to seize Mr. Tan and then start investigating, asking him questions. And that may be how we distinguish from a general raid on a drug house.
What is the distinction? I mean, how would you be able to distinguish the two situations?
Because
they're going to have, I mean, in a usual case, they've been doing surveillance. They see one or two guys doing the drug runs. They know this is a drug house. They go in, and there's other people there. And are you claiming that those other people can just leave and the officer doesn't have a right to make them stay and ask them questions?
Yes, I am. I think if there's no reasonable basis to conclude they're engaged in criminal activity, they are not lawfully seized by law enforcement. And I think in that situation, maybe it's hard to speculate maybe in a hypothetical.
Right. Well, I mean, I just don't know what the difference is because
sure.
A lot of times I know officers, when they do that, they insist on everyone standing still because they've got their own safety
for sure
involved.
And I think
can
there
can
maybe
I,
is
can
some...
Can
oh,
I
sorry.
Ask a question here?
Sure.
So It sounds like you're trying to, you said there's, you have to have a basis for concluding that there is criminal activity. So is that the issue then, as to what criminal activity
specific
appellant
to
was
Mr.
involved
Tom.
In? Correct.
Correct. So there may be criminal activity occurring, but that does not mean officers get to seize anyone in the area and direct their investigation towards them.
So in a hypothetical, like such as Judge Hooten is, usually you've got people milling about, they're active, and come in, all of a sudden I was like, okay, freeze, somebody's got hands on a scale, passing drugs, blah, blah, blah. Whereas in this situation...
Correct. In that situation, there's, I think, clear criminal drug activity happening in that location, right? If there's scales, if people are doing things. Here, everything that related to criminal activity was observed in a different location. And they used it to enter Mr. Tan's hotel room. They walk in. There's no apparent threat or exigent circumstances that require sort of a temporary seizure of the individuals there.
And there's no search incident to arrest.
Correct. Correct. And there's nothing in plain view. They simply walk in his hotel room while he's asleep.
So he's sleeping.
He's asleep in the bed. They walk in because this friend said he was staying in this room. No drugs in plain view, but they wake him up and immediately start asking him questions about criminal activity. Even though it's unclear whether they even knew he was going to be in this room when they went up there. And again, that's what I think
I'm sorry, finish your thought and then I'll
ask
my question.
I was just gonna go back to that same point. The Constitution, both US and Minnesota constitutions require that individualized assessment. If you wanna seize some individuals, you've gotta be able to point to each of them, articulate facts as to each that justifies their specific seizures. It's not enough that companions may be engaged in criminal drug activity. We talked, that's, I think in the DD case, the Ingram case, and the Dickerson case. This is a recurring theme. It's not enough that some companions are engaged in criminal drug activity. You gotta show what the seized individual is doing or has done. And here, they're not even really companions. They're never observed with Mr. Tan until they let the officers in this hotel room.
But the officer was suspicious of the vehicle for narcotics activity, such as a pickup, which would involve bringing drugs to or from the car. And if Mr. Tan isn't, so doesn't that provide a reasonable suspicion, having seen these people go back and forth from the room, or one of them go back and forth and the other come down to this car, and then seeing that all three are staying in the same room, why doesn't that provide a reasonable suspicion that Mr. Tan could be involved with these two other individuals in some sort of narcotics activity, whether it be, you know, use of narcotics or selling of narcotics?
Well, I think, and I may be just repeating myself a bit, but we're seeing individuals looking in a car in a hotel parking lot. That's all the officers observe for a minute or so on sort of within a 20-minute or so window. They come back and forth between the car. We would submit that's not suspicious in a hotel parking lot. Guests go back and forth between their cars with some regularity. They're never observed carrying anything with them that is suspicious at all. And regardless, whatever is observed and whatever they learn through the questioning of those individuals does not relate either to the room or to Mr. Tan.
Okay. All right. So why don't we briefly address consent, because you have not much time left.
Thank
I
you.
Know you have a rebuttal, but if you can briefly address the consent issue. Sorry, Judge Hooten.
No, that's fine.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Right. I think the consent, again, this is, I think, a secondary argument that the court does not even need to reach. But here we have a situation where Mr. Tan is asleep in a hotel room that he rented and is awoken by two uniformed officers who have walked in the room without his consent, without a warrant, without, and then immediately start investigating criminal activity. They're immediately peppering him with questions. They're immediately asking whether he has drugs in the room, has unregistered guests. There's, I think it's a relatively low bar. We're simply asking what a reasonable person in that situation have felt comfortable to decline that line of questioning. And we cited a number of cases in our brief. One of the important factors in this is that he is asleep, right? He's sleeping in his hotel room, and the officers, he's woken up with two uniformed officers standing over his bed. We think in that situation, Mr. Tan was not in a position to voluntarily consent to the search of his hotel room. Same amount of time.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The police suspected drugs in room 340 and had reasonable articulable suspicion that drugs would be found in the room.
That's a different issue, though, of whether or not they had reasonable suspicion to seize appellant, though, isn't it?
At each step of the investigation, reasonable articulable suspicion is required. And so the
Correct.
First step of the investigation is, did they have reasonable articulable suspicion to believe drugs would be found in room 340? The second question is that the appellant raises is the entry into the room itself. And then there's the brief seizure of the appellant as the police enter the room, freeze the scene, and he wakes up and they ask him some questions. So there is whether they had reasonable articulable suspicion at that point to freeze the scene and ask the appellant questions, that is a question that is before the court.
Right, so what is a reasonable suspicion? What are the factors showing that he was engaged in criminal activity? The person who was asleep, you got police officers come in, they're told that the person who let them in the room, that appellant was the actual renter of the room, right?
Correct.
And they go in and he's asleep.
Right.
So, and he wasn't in the car, he wasn't observed going back and forth between the car, wasn't questioned before, he's not engaged in activity in that hotel room. So what facts show that he is engaged in criminal activity? Mr. Tan, explicitly.
So this is a point of dispute here, because the thing that ties drugs to Mr. Tan specifically is the fact that there are the person who goes down to the car, the second person who goes down to the car, digging around. The police at that point, in a known area of narcotics activity of this particular hotel, investigating as they do this known area of narcotics, think that this car is being used as a drop-off and a pickup point for narcotics sales or narcotics activity. The second person who comes down to the room after the first person comes down twice, rummages around, and leaves, they stop him and says, I'm staying in room 340. That gives them reasonable articulable suspicion to investigate further to find out if there are drugs in room 340. When they entered the room with Mr. Schultz using his hotel key card to open the door, allow the police into the room, at that point they seize the room thinking that there are drugs existing in that room given that it's a narcotics area and given the suspicious activity they just observed with a person who is staying in that room. That when they enter the room, this is, as Judge Hooten said, no different than any other sort of activity where the police come in on a drug bust and freeze the scene. They freeze the scene, he wakes up, they ask him a few questions, and he consents to a search. They search, they
okay.
find drugs.
You haven't told me anything about what facts tie it specifically to appellant, though.
Yeah, I don't think you have to tie it specifically.
I think you do. I think the case law says very clearly that it has to be individualized and particularized to the person.
And it's particularized to everybody who was staying in that room.
You're making it
the
general. I don't think you can do that, though, counsel. I think you have to show how this particular person is tied to suspicious activity.
But the rule of law that appellant is advocating for and that you would adopt if you rule in that way in reverse is that when the police enter the room and freeze a scene, anybody else and suspect that drugs are going to be found in this hotel room, is that the appellant is then supposed to be let go. The police are supposed to say, you know, you...
I don't think that's what...
That's
the conclusion. The conclusion is, if you're going to seize someone, which you don't, the parties, I think, are in agreement that they're, according to your briefs, that Mr. Tan was seized, you have to have a reasonable, articulable suspicion for seizing him. And then any, the search of the room that follows has to be from a lawful seizure. So in order to search following that, there has to be reasonable, articulable suspicion tied to him that there's drugs in the room. And that's what we're trying to focus on here.
And so there's two answers to that question. One is that the police learned from Mr. Schultz that he is the registered person of this hotel room.
Well, I don't think they... Did they, if he's registered, then why did they suspect that he was unregistered? That
Mr. Tan was the registered person of the hotel room.
Okay.
And that from so that ties Mr. Tan directly to that hotel room, which they suspect that drugs exist inside that hotel room.
And so you think those facts are enough?
Those facts are enough.
A reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Which is an extremely low bar.
But you still have to trip over it, as Justice Hudson has eloquently stated in the past.
True.
But you still have to have, and I'm going to quote from State v. Lago, Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2016, an officer must have, quote, a particularized and objective basis for suspecting the particular person stopped of criminal activity. And it seems to be a stretch that I think there's reasonable suspicion. I would tend to agree with you that there's reasonable suspicion that the two other individuals may be involved in criminal activity and the police have an objective basis to pursue that. But you have somebody that's asleep in the room who is the registered owner while this alleged criminal activity is going on. I'm failing to see how the criminal activity of the two other individuals ties to him while he's sleeping.
The criminal activity is they are thinking that this could be a drug sale, that this could be being used as a pickup point, the car.
How is he involved when he's sleeping?
That he may be involved in an enterprise of selling drugs, that the room is tied to the car based on the drugs being found in the car, the person saying, I'm staying in this room, and this person is the registered person at that hotel room.
Was there anything seen being taken out of or transported between the car and the hotel room?
No.
So even the connection between the car and the hotel room is tenuous then. All you know is that he's got a key to this hotel room, right?
That is a pretty key connection to the hotel room, is the fact that he has a key card to the room. But yes, that is one connection. The other thing the officer testified that he was investigating is the statutory requirement that everybody be registered in a hotel room.
But and how would that, why would a search the room be necessary tied to that question of whether there's unregistered guests in the room?
That allows for the brief seizure. And then they are then questioning the appellant at that point and suspect drugs are in the room, asked for, and the seizure
unregistered guests, why don't the police just go down to the front desk to see whether or not the people that in the car, you don't even have to go up to the room. You can just go to the front desk and see whether or not they're actually registered guests or not.
And somebody did.
Well, and is there even evidence in the record that to suspect that there were unregistered guests in the room? I mean, was there any inquiry of, I didn't see that in the record, any inquiry of AS or KJ prior to going in the room and any inquiry as to whether they had registered with the front desk?
It's unclear what Mr. Schultz had answered to was that the appellant had rented the room. the police then suspected.
But that doesn't say anything whether or not he's registered.
It doesn't, no. And somebody else did go to the front desk to check. The record is unclear when exactly that happened. But somebody did go to the front desk to check that. That goes into the argument that this is the brief seizure that occurred when the police enter the room to suspect that drugs are in this room. Yes, the appellant is there in the room, that they have a right to freeze the room to investigate further. Now, the investigation may be linked to these other folks, but the person said this is the person who has rented the room, and that's why the police asked the renter of the room for consent to search the room.
So let's go to the consent issue. This seems to be a very, very different situation than like the typical ones, like, for instance, applied consent, where we've got the person, the famous case of, it starts with a B, I can't think of the name of it now, where he's familiar with the whole system and basically is trying to game the system. Here you've got somebody who's asleep. You've got two uniformed police officers. They come in. They rouse him from his slumber. They wake him up, immediately start asking him questions, acknowledge that he did appear groggy and out of it, not uncommon if you're woken up. They start asking him questions. They never ask him, they never tell him that he couldn't consent to a search. And then they immediately ask him if they can search the apartment. How is that a valid consent? Those facts don't seem to lend themselves to a conclusion that he validly consented to a search of the room.
Well, under the Dizzo case, you look to the totality of the circumstances.
Correct, and I just listed.
You did, and you left out some of them. One is that this appellant has had interactions with law enforcement in the past. A second key
point. Right,
and
the two past experiences he said that he had with law enforcement were relatively cordial.
Sure.
But we don't know much else other than the details of what were the circumstances of those.
We don't know.
So
but
that's
we
why
also,
I didn't know if that's really how relevant that really is to the.
It goes to the totality of circumstances that he did have interactions with police in the past. But that also goes to another key point that was not listed in the totality of circumstances there, is that Tan admitted that he thought he could say no. And that was his testimony. He told the police, I thought at that time I could say no to this search. And that's at page 56 of the transcript.
He also testified that he was scared and confused.
Sure, and the
officers never told him he had a right to refuse.
Correct, but the Dizzo case says just because the encounter is uncomfortable doesn't mean that it's an invalid search.
True,
invalid
but I think
consent.
This goes a little bit beyond just being uncomfortable. I mean, I don't know how many people would like to be awoken with two officers uniformed police officers standing over them in what is basically their residence at that time under the law.
Sure, but again, the key testimony, and this it would have to be a clear error that the district court made in finding that the consent was valid, is that he said he thought he could say no. And the district court's finding on this fact that the consent was valid is not clearly erroneous because
but
it is
like
supported
out,
by the
you
record.
You do have to look at the totality of circumstances. You're highlighting one statement that he made, which is contradicted by his testimony that he was scared and confused.
Correct, but then this would be replacing, this is a clearly erroneous standard on this point. The district court made a finding on that. The finding is supported by the facts of what his testimony is and the rest of the totality of the circumstances that the police thought that this was a potential buy situation where the car is being used as a pickup point, that there may be additional drugs. Now, it turns out it wasn't. It wasn't a sale situation. There was a small amount of cocaine that was found in the room. But in that at that time that they're furthering their investigation, they thought that this might be a sale activity involved in narcotic sales. So when they go into the room, and he says, I felt I could say no. I have had good encounters with the police in the past. The totality of the circumstances, he certainly may have been uncomfortable at that time, but the consent was valid, and that is not a clearly erroneous fact finding by the district court. Very briefly, the entry into the hotel room itself was also valid. That is something that the person had both apparent authority or apparent authority. He had a hotel key. which gave him actual authority to let the police into the room. At a minimum, it was apparent authority, which is something that you look at. Would a reasonable officer at the time suspect this person could let me in the room? And that was a valid entry into the hotel room, which was one of the other factors that appellant challenged. Unless the court has any other questions, I think the briefs sufficiently cover everything.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So, Your Honors, just very briefly, I think we hit the nail on the head with some of the early questioning. There's a distinction between room 340 and Mr. Tom. Whether the officers can enter the room and conduct a search there, and whether they can seize Mr. Tan and start investigating him for criminal activity are separate inquiries. And that's all we're asking the court to do, is to apply those cases, the Askruth case that requires that individualized assessment as to each person seized.
Well, what about the argument of the state that here we do have facts? We have, what gave rise to these reasonable suspicions were that these two individuals appear to be engaged in kind of a cell operation where they kept going to the car and apparently the judge found that this were the facts, and that they were staying in room 340, which the officer indicated he was suspicious there were drugs in 340, and that we know that Mr. Vaughn was the registered owner of that room. He was the person that was basically providing the room that served as the basis for this, what the police thought was a drug operation. Is that enough? I guess that's the question.
Well,
No, it's not.
And I think the first part is that we would submit there's not reasonable suspicion to investigate the other two individuals for criminal drug activity. We recognize we don't have standing to do so, but the officer sees guys rummaging in a car in a hotel parking lot, and based on that, he decides to approach. Then even though he observes nothing going back and forth between the hotel, even when he does look in the car, he finds a single marijuana pipe and a container containing some marijuana wax residue. That's it. And they tell him there aren't drugs in the room. There's no, I think, reasonable suspicion that there are even drugs in room 340. But regardless, even if they get to go up to the room, they've still got to look what's specific to Mr. Tan. And they don't have anything but for he rented a room. I mean, I was thinking about what the analogy would be sort of to my own life, right? And my wife and I had a dinner party recently. The rule that the district court applied and what the state is asking is if one of my dinner guests is stopped by police outside my home on the street, they find some marijuana or a pipe and wax residue in his car, her car. They ask, where are you going? I'm going up to Luke and Kristen's house. Take me up there with you. He gets to walk into my room because an invited guest to my dinner parties has marijuana in his car. There's this, it's something we tried to highlight in our brief, but maybe we didn't. I mean, there is a clear distinction between what happens at a car and what happens at someone's home. And I think that's a really important line that we have to draw.
Well, here's to your analogy, wouldn't a better analogy be if you're, someone has rented a house and you're staying in a room in their house and you have a key to get in the house, but you're not on the lease?
Maybe. I mean, it's certainly an imperfect analogy.
And so if the police have reason to suspect that you have drugs, does that give them reason to suspect you have drugs in the house? Does that give them reason to suspect that the person on the lease has drugs in the house too?
Absolutely not. And that's right. What the officer did is he used drugs in a car, someone else's car, other individuals, to walk into someone else's home. I mean, that should, without a warrant, without getting consent, well, the individual is asleep. That should offend us. And there's a clear way to fix this, right? I think I see my time's about to run out. I started by saying this was a simple but important case, right? It's a simple case because we're not asking for a new rule or to overrule any precedent. We're just simply asking that you apply the case law that clearly applies that requires that individualized assessment as to each individual who is seized, right? It's an important case because I think this case has helped illustrate how easily lines get blurred and rights eroded, right? Simply because other individuals are maybe engaged in criminal activity does not justify officers going to another location, entering a home, and without a warrant, without consent, and seizing anyone who's there, right? This is, I think, an opportunity for the court to issue a clear reminder to lower courts and law enforcement where those lines should be drawn. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel. It was very well argued and very well briefed. We always appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both. That's our last case on our oral calendar, and with that, court is adjourned.